guidelines, the situation remains volatile in Kherson in anticipation of a Ukrainian offensive to recapture the city from Russian forces. North Korea says it has no arms dealings with Russia, accusing the U.S. of seeking to tarnish its image with such rumors. Plus, Americans start voting in midterm elections and will decide control of Congress amid deep political polarization. Hello and welcome, everybody. Kiev accuses the Russian military of setting the stage for street fighting in Kherson ahead of an expected offensive by Ukraine to retake the city. The Ukrainian military says Russia is forcing civilians to leave the city, saying this amounts to war crime. The military also says Russian forces disguised in civilian clothes are plundering evacuated homes. Moscow denies the accusation. It says it's vacating the area to ensure the safety of the residents. Kherson is one of the eastern Ukrainian regions that Russia annexed after holding referendums there. The Ukrainian military is pushing counteroffensives to take back those regions and other Russian-held territory. Kiev's campaign has been propped up by Western arms. Ukraine now says that it has received the first shipment of advanced surface-to-air missile systems pledged by Western countries. Earlier, our correspondent Johnny Miller joined us from Sevastopol with the latest on the situation in Kherson.
Russia has been evacuating civilians from there for over a week. Now, I spoke to some of those refugees here in Sevastopol a few days ago. Most of them saying they're happy to be evacuated. They say Ukraine is shelling the city, so they've had to leave for their own safety. Another reason that Russia's evacuating civilians there is that they're worried about saboteurs. Of course, Crimea, where I am now, is overwhelmingly Russian. Donbass, particularly the east of Donbass, overwhelmingly Russian. But in Kherson, it's very mixed. A lot of Russians, a lot of Ukrainians, and some Ukrainian insurgents, if you like, not sure else to call them, have been having some success there. I mean, for weeks now, I've been seeing images from around Kherson of Ukraine launching small attacks towards the city. Most of those attacks, well, all of those attacks being repelled by Russia. But I have seen videos of Ukraine amassing large forces there. Meanwhile, NATO continued to supply weaponry, some more anti-air defense going towards Ukraine. But we've had, this war is over, it's around 8 months old, and we've had many, we've been told, game-changing weapons given by NATO to Ukraine. None of them have really changed the game. So these new anti-air defenses around Kiev, they've come rather late. Ukraine would have hoped that these anti-air defense would have happened before Russia started destroying their energy infrastructure.
North Korea has rejected as groundless U.S. claims that Pyongyang is supplying arms and munitions to Russia for the war in Ukraine. Pyongyang says it has never had arms dealings with Russia and has no plans to do so in the future. It says rumors of arms dealing with Russia are a hostile attempt by the U.S. to tarnish the image of North Korea. Last week, Washington said artillery was being delivered from North Korea to Russia under the cover of shipments to West Asia or Africa. Jennifer Chang says the U.S. has not provided any evidence for its claims about North Korea supplying arms to Russia.
Well, the U.S. has not really provided any evidence for its claim issued by the U.S. National Security Council spokesman for the White House, John Kirby, last week that North Korea is supplying Russia with artillery shells and ammunition for its war in Ukraine by funneling them through unspecified countries, either in the Middle East or North Africa. And Kirby said he has an idea, the U.S. government has an idea of which countries those were, but he did not specify which ones. And there was no real solid evidence to support the claim. And in fact, the U.S. is saying that they can indeed stop these transfers of weapons from North Korea to Russia, possibly, perhaps by delaying them in customs or holding them up there permanently. But it's very, very intangible. And the North Koreans got very upset.
Americans are heading to the polls in midterm elections that could see Republicans take over both houses of Congress. Opinion polls show Republicans are heading for a win in both the House and the Senate. A shift in power in the chambers would make Democratic President Joe Biden a lame duck for his remaining 2 years in office. Democrats have been campaigning around what they call the threat a Republican win would pose to U.S. democracy. Republicans, however, have focused their campaign on such issues as soaring inflation and the scale of violent crimes. And to stay with the story, U.S. President Joe Biden has sounded the alarm over threats to democracy in his closing argument ahead of the midterm elections.
Democracy is on the ballot. Political violence and intimidation are on the rise all across America. And you remember January 6th, the angry mob that stormed the U.S. Capitol, attacked law enforcement, hunted down elected officials, erected gallows to hang Vice President Pence. Well, West's opponent supported that mob. Who the hell do they think they are?
Also, former U.S. President Donald Trump says that he's expecting a Republican victory in the elections. Trump has also vowed to make a big announcement next week, hinting that he's going to run for the 2024 presidential election.
This is the year we're going to take back the House, we're going to take back the Senate, and we're going to take back America. And in 2024, most importantly, we are going to take back our magnificent White House. I'm going to be making a very big announcement on Tuesday, November 15th, at Mar-a-Lago in Palm Beach, Florida.
China urges Canada to stop making remarks that damage bilateral relations after Ottawa accused Beijing of trying to interfere in its elections.
The relationship between countries can only be built on the basis of mutual respect, equality, and mutual benefit. And China-Canada relations are no exception. Canada should stop making remarks that are detrimental to China-Canada relations. China is not interested in Canada's internal affairs.
Canada's Prime Minister has accused Beijing of playing aggressive games to undermine democratic institutions in the country. It's a reference to media reports that China funded a clandestine network of candidates in Canada's 2019 elections. This comes amid a probe into allegations that China used police outposts in Canada to carry out illegal security operations against Chinese nationals. China has denied the accusation, saying the locations only offer services to its nationals. Israel has been denounced for its decision to outlaw several Palestinian rights groups as terrorist organizations ahead of one of the rights bodies told UN investigators that the regime's move was, quote, like an execution designed to stop them from probing abuses. He made the revelation during public hearings hosted by a team of UN Human Rights Council appointed to probe the underlying causes in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Israel has harshly criticized the hearings while refusing to cooperate with the team that will also look into the May killing of Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akleh. In October last year, Israel designated six Palestinian civil society groups as terrorists and accused them of financing the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. The Israeli decision then sparked widespread international outrage. From Ramallah, our correspondent Mona Kandil says the NGO's efforts to file a lawsuit in the International Criminal Court has angered Israel.
The work of these organizations in the last years were very clear. They wanted to expose the Israeli crimes, tell the world about the ongoing Israeli aggression against the Palestinians, going to the areas where Israeli military seize Palestinian homelands, force people out of their homes, taking testimonies from Palestinians, documenting all the crimes. Many Palestinians were killed in cold blood, and those organizations had testimonies from family members, and they brought witnesses in order to prepare, cases to take it to the International Criminal Court. This, of course, had angered the Israeli regime, and that's why the Israelis had been doing their utmost in order to stop the work of these six organizations. They didn't find anything but to say that they are terrorists and they fund terrorist organizations in the Palestinian territories.
Iran has summoned Norway's ambassador to Tehran over remarks made by the country's parliament speaker against the Islamic Republic, the foreign ministry condemned as unacceptable remarks made by Masoud Gharahani during an interview with an anti-Iran Saudi-backed television network based in London. The ministry also censured the Norwegian official for his interference in Iran's internal affairs. In his interview, Gharahani had encouraged those behind the recent riots in Iran to continue their actions. The Norwegian diplomat said he will immediately convey Iran's protests to Oslo. Eurozone finance ministers meet in Brussels to exchange views on the EU's worsening energy crisis. Governments in the bloc have so far failed to mitigate the economic costs associated with cutting off Russia's cheap gas supplies. Jerome Hughes reports from the Belgian capital.
It is blatantly obvious that Brussels is losing its energy war with Moscow as prices across the 19-country eurozone continue to skyrocket. Washington is benefiting by selling gas to the EU at a high price. Eurozone finance ministers met on Monday to assess the crisis.
We are focusing now also within the European Commission, within the General Council, how we can, and then also with the ministers of energy that are focusing on how we can reduce that cost in the near future.
The poorest are feeling the pain most. Eye-watering amounts have been spent to try and compensate.
Euro area governments have so far collectively spent about 1.25% on energy supports for the year, so about 200 billion euro.
Of course, it's all linked to the EU's attempts to isolate Russia over the war in Ukraine. It's costing EU taxpayers billions of euro to house Ukrainian refugees, supply weapons to the Ukrainian army, and fund the government in Kiev. Ordinary workers will have to pay for it, but the eurozone economy is beginning to flatline.
Inflation continues to be high, even surprisingly high for both Europe and the United States. Sentiment indicators are very low, indicating a risk of recession.
It appears the European Union is now in damage control mode.
I am telling that we can work, should work, to avoid that this is a prolonged period of recession.
Peace activists are calling on the EU to mediate between Russia and Ukraine, but those calls appear to be falling on deaf ears. Many people are now nervously wondering, is there an unemployment catastrophe looming in the eurozone? Whether they are being overly pessimistic or merely realistic, there's no doubt a growing number of economists are suggesting the eurozone is heading for a deep, prolonged recession. Jerome Hughes at the Council of the EU. Brussels.
The United Nations Secretary General has warned of climate chaos as over 120 world leaders converge in Egypt for the COP27 summit. The event is focused on discussing climate change, the world response so far, and how to tackle the challenges climate change is posing to different countries.
In UN's climate change summit, Secretary General Antonio Guterres responded to a UN report released on Sunday by saying that the planet is sending a distress signal.
Greenhouse gas emissions are now on course to rise by 10%. And meanwhile, temperatures are on course to rise by as much as 2.8 degrees with the present policies in place by the end of the century. And that means our planet is on course for reaching tipping points and that will make climate chaos irreversible and forever bake in catastrophic temperature rise. We need to move from tipping points to turning points for hope.
The report had indicated that the past 8 years are said to have had the warmest climates to ever be recorded. The report had also indicated that global temperatures have risen by 1.15 degrees Celsius since the pre-industrial era, catastrophically accelerating rise in sea levels, glacier mass loss, and unprecedented heat waves. World leaders are discussing solutions in Sharm el-Sheikh's Red Sea Resort in Egypt, while the event is hosted by the Egyptian foreign minister, who emphasized on the magnitude of the challenge that now faces the world. The outgoing chair of the talks and British official Alok Sharma mentioned some political reasons as one of the major causes for the impediment of global efforts concerning the environment, specifically the Ukraine war.
War in Ukraine has precipitated multiple global crises: energy and food insecurity, inflationary pressures, and spiraling debt. And these crises have compounded existing climate vulnerabilities and the scarring effects of the pandemic.
But then he went back on the topic of actual climate catastrophes and pointed out the devastating Pakistan and Nigeria floods, as well as unprecedented droughts in Europe, China, and the US. Speaking of, US President Joe Biden is expected to attend the event later in the week. He's usually enthusiastic about climate events. After all, it was Biden who got the US back into the Paris Climate Accord after Trump pulled out of it. But apparently, neither his Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping nor Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi are expected to attend, with China and India being among the biggest polluters of the world. Their absence has cast much doubt over the effectiveness of any potential deal planned to cut emissions during the summit.
That's it with the world news for now. Bye, everybody.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
When experts and even American citizens say democracy is under threat in the US, there is no exaggeration. According to Americans for Tax Fairness, billionaires have poured hundreds of millions of dollars into campaign this cycle, largely to benefit Republican candidates. In this regard, we have taken a look at some world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for the second part, please. According to the website of Truthout, a small group of billionaires who come from the top 0.2% of wealthiest people in the U.S. have spent nearly $900 million in the federal midterm runoffs this election cycle, a new report finds, and could reach $1 billion in political spending by the time the cycle is over. According to a report released recently by Americans for Tax Fairness, ATF, just 465 American billionaires had donated an unprecedented $881 million by the end of September. Even before last-minute campaign pushes in the last 5 weeks before Election Day, this is already more than the amount that billionaires spent in the entirety of the 2018 midterm election. Further, the vast majority of this spending, $643 million, or 73%, comes from just 20 billionaire households, including prominent figures like the Koch family, Peter Thiel, George Soros, Michael and Susan Bloomberg, and Jeffrey Yass. Of the top 10 donor families, 8 lean Republican, while 2 lean Democrat. This is a staggering amount of money spent by an astoundingly small number of people in order to influence elections that will affect the entire U.S. population and beyond. The data is a stark illustration of the vast amount of influence that billionaires have over the political system and that has been afforded to them by conservative tax cutting and Citizens United v. Federal Elections Commission, which allows billionaires and corporations to spend unlimited amounts of money on elections. Indeed, as the report finds, this small group of billionaires has spent 27 times more on this election than they ever spent around 2010, when Citizens United was decided in the 2010 election cycle. For instance, billionaires spent $32 million. The majority of the $881 million spent this cycle has gone toward Republicans by a 3-2 margin, ATF finds. Democrats have received about 39% of the funding, while 59% has gone towards Republicans. The rest of the funding, 2%, has gone toward causes that most progressives oppose, like supporting Israel or cryptocurrency, ATF finds. There has also been a massive influx of fundraising for super PACs that are created for a single candidate. Such donations have risen by 150% between 2018 and this election cycle, increasing from $128 million to $223 million as of the beginning of November. About 75% of single candidate super PAC spending goes toward Republicans, the report finds. Such massive injections into elections are often more than just a political donation. They can represent huge tax savings for billionaires in the future or win them other political favors. They aren't donating to candidates because they like them. This is a transaction, wrote former Ohio State Senator Nina Turner about the report recently. Indeed, billionaires have gained trillions of dollars of wealth throughout the past few years. This growth is at least partially due to a tax code that is written to favor the rich, in part because billionaires push candidates to do so. Yes, for instance, has dodged $1 billion in taxes over the past 6 years, while billionaire donor Ken Griffin spent $54 million to shut down a tax-raising initiative, a move that is now saving him tens of millions of dollars in taxes each year. Newly uncovered emails from key figures on former President Donald Trump's legal team show that his lawyers viewed embattled Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas as a powerful secret weapon and perhaps their only influential legal ally in their plan to overturn the 2020 election, according to an email exchange from December 2020 obtained by congressional investigators and reported by Politico. At least two lawyers on Trump's legal team believed that Thomas was their only chance to legally challenge the results of the election before the election certification date rolled around. "We want to frame things so that Thomas could be the one to issue some sort of a stay or other circuit justice opinion saying Georgia is in legitimate doubt," Trump attorney Kenneth Chesebro wrote in an email addressed to Trump's legal team on December 31, 2020. "Realistically, our only chance to get a favorable judicial opinion by January 6, which might hold up the Georgia count in Congress, is from Thomas. Do you agree, Professor John Eastman?" "I think I agree with this," replied Eastman, a Trump lawyer who was key in crafting the plan to overturn the election. "If the court were to give us key, that might be enough to kick the Georgia legislature into gear, because I have been getting a lot of calls from them indicating to me they are leaning that way," he said. Around the same time as the Thomas emails, Trump's lawyers were scrambling to get the then president to sign onto documents that they worried had voter fraud statistics that could invite legal trouble for him down the line. "I have no doubt that aggressive DA or U.S. attorney someplace will go after both the president and his lawyers once all the dust settles on this," Eastman wrote on two other Trump lawyers. They ended up removing the figures, which led them to another problem. They were facing a tight deadline, but Trump was on a plane without access to a notary. "There is no one they can call to come to the White House that's a notary," one GOP tied attorney wrote, adding, "I don't know how we file without it. Presidential trip to a UPS store?" They ultimately got a White House clerk to attest to the document signing, which ended up being key to the federal judge's decision to order Eastman to turn over the emails. The emails, the judge wrote, show that President Trump knew that specific numbers of voter fraud were wrong, but continued to tout those numbers both in court and to the public. And that is why experts and even American citizens say democracy is under threat in the U.S., and this is no exaggeration.
The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I welcome you all to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge, where we are discussing about the topic of prophethood. And we are currently focusing on the first and the second sermons where Imam Ali alayhi salam explained some very important issues with regards to prophethood. Basically, the grounds and the conditions which were present on the earth amongst the people of the world that led to the coming of the messengers. And we discussed previously that Imam Ali alayhi salam, in the second sermon, he mentions some of those circumstances, some of those conditions, and he says that وَخُذِلَ الْإِيمَانُ وَتَنَكَّرَتْ مَعَالِمُهُ وَدَرَسَتْ سُبُلُهُ وَعَفَتْ شُرُكُهُ أَطَاعُ الشَّيْطَانَ فَسَلَكُوا مَسَالِكَهُ وَوَرَدُوا مَنَاهِلَهُ. He talks about the fact that these people, what happened to them, they started to follow the shaitan, and unfortunately they disobeyed Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. They started to disobey and all that. And then what happened is that shaitan made use of them to continue the path of oppression, and to continue the path of misguidance, using the same very people. And then after that, because of their situation, they got squashed under the hooves of the devils. And then they were destroyed. Their lives became destroyed. Their purpose in life and everything was deviated. This was basically the circumstance. And one of the most important things of this era, the era before the coming of the messengers, was the state of confusion and the state of whereby these people did not know their direction very well. And this is when we noticed that the messengers and the prophets came to show the light.
You are listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
Now, when you look at the situation of the world, and you notice that people in different parts of the world, they faced oppression, they faced subjugation at the time of the prophets and messengers. And also today, if you see, that same situation is there. And people are in search of a solution to this subjugation and oppression and the state of confusion. If you look at the world today, the way the colonial powers, they controlled large swaths of land on earth very wrongfully, taking over people's lives and hearts and minds, taking over people's hearts and lives and minds without permission. And this was something that was quite detrimental for the progress of the Muslim Ummah and for the humanity at large. And in order to come out of the confusion that people had, they sat together, they decided that they need to fight against this colonial rule and overcome this oppression. And they were able to a certain degree, able to come out of this. But then the hegemonic powers, they decided to wage another form of war and another method of control, and that is controlling the mind. And when you talk about controlling the mind, it's about the media, it's about about the media and the movies and the social media and all of that. So they started to work on that, to change the thoughts, to change the way people think, to change the way people react, their emotions, their states, what they think is right, what they think is wrong. And all of this started as what we call a soft war. And unfortunately, a large portion of the world fell victim to this war. And many people were not able to, you know, fight against it. Many communities are still under the hegemony of the West. They are under the cultural influence of the West. They are under the cultural control of the West. Though they are not under them in terms of, a political rule, governance and all that. But yet the governance is happening in a very soft way. And this is the reality of the world today.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
Now, brothers and sisters, when you talk about the fact that the world is still under some level of hegemonic control, it is true. You look at a large portion of the world, you will see that it's the economic system that is being propagated by the West that is in control of majority of the world. You look at the information that comes to our screens, and majority of what we feed our eyes and our minds and our souls and our hearts comes from another source. And therefore, though we aren't subjugated in a completely, you can say, forcefully external apparent manner, naturally our hearts and minds have been trained to do what the Western leaders, the Western authorities want. Okay, and that's how they are propagating the world, how they're propagating their systems. You can see that they'll forcefully introduced let's say same gender marriage, while it might not be something that many of the cultures of the world may not be palatable to many of the cultures of the world, but still they will force it. Or the different other things that they have in mind, their idea of gender, the idea of who a human being is and the purpose and everything. So they're slowly working on these things through their educational systems, through their cultural apparatus, and through their social media platforms. And therefore, that confusion even today is even worse. That confusion that Imam Ali alayhi salam mentioned, that the people, da'ihun, they are in a state of confusion, they don't know their purpose, they don't know their direction, it is there even today. But there were a few countries that were able to come out of this cultural invasion, cultural influence, and one of those countries, without a doubt, is the Islamic Republic of Iran. That it propagated a new system, a new way of thinking, a new methodology of analyzing the situation of the world based on monotheism and Quranic principles that made the people very much unvulnerable and uncontrollable with regards to their beliefs and culture. Inshallah, we shall discuss this in the coming sessions. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
Join us in this journey, IRIB English Radio.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Ever since Mohammed bin Salman became Saudi Arabia's crown prince in 2017, the kingdom has been involved in numerous cases of human rights abuses. They include Riyadh's arresting and imprisoning of hundreds of activists, bloggers, intellectuals, critics, and other people for their political activism. The Saudi regime is showing zero tolerance for hearing the dissent voice, even in the face of international condemnation. The kingdom is trying to suppress these people in various ways, including spying on them using Israeli malware. We have taken a look at some of the world media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. Associated Press news agency writes, an investigative report revealed that Saudi Arabia has stepped up its crackdown on dissent on the United States soil using an Israeli spyware. The report published on Wednesday, 2nd of November, found out that the Saudi kingdom had been monitoring dissent's communications using the military-grade Israeli software. Upon spotting instances of dissent, the kingdom would then resort to handing out heavy sentences and imprisoning the targeted individuals if they return home. The report says, according to the FBI human rights groups and 2 years of interviews with Saudis living abroad over the last 5 years, Saudi surveillance, intimidation and pursuit of Saudis on U.S. soil have intensified as the kingdom steps up repression under Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. This is by far not the first time that the kingdom has been found culpable of practicing the procedure which is known as transnational repression. The Associated Press report cites the instance of Abdullah bin Faisal Al Saud, a Saudi prince who is a graduate student at Boston's Northeastern University. The Saudi royal was arrested and jailed on a trip back home after Saudi officials found out that he had been discussing Riyadh's imprisonment of his cousin, a fellow prince, with his relatives whilst in the United States. The report added, Abdullah bin Faisal Al Saud was imprisoned because of those calls. An initial 20-year sentence was hiked to 30 years in August. In the same month that Prince Abdullah's sentence was lengthened, Saudi Arabia gave a 72-year-old Saudi-American citizen, Saad al-Mahdi, a virtual life sentence for tweets that he had posted from his home in Florida. Saad al-Mahdi, who was imprisoned on a visit to Saudi Arabia. Freedom House, a research and advocacy group, announced that Saudi Arabia has targeted critics in 14 countries. Citing the group, Associated Press reported, the aim is to spy on Saudi citizens and intimidate them or compel them to return to the kingdom. Freedom House's Nate Shenkhan said of the recent imprisonments of Western-based Saudis, it is disturbing, it's terrifying, and it's a major violation of protected speech. The Saudi kingdom is also charged with ordering the 2018 murder of dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi, a US-Saudi citizen who used to be a vocal critic of the Saudi royal family. Jamal Khashoggi was dismembered during a visit to the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, Turkey. Human rights groups say the Israeli spyware had been installed on the phone of Jamal Khashoggi's fiancée. Meanwhile, the British newspaper The Guardian has more on the same story. In the wake of the brutal murder of the journalist Jamal Khashoggi, the NSO group denied that its government clients had used its hacking malware to target the journalist or his family. Now, a joint investigation by The Guardian and other media, based on leaked data and forensic analysis of phones, has uncovered new evidence that the Zionist regime's spyware developed by NSO Group was used to try and monitor people close to Jamal Khashoggi both before and after his death. According to peer-reviewed forensic analysis of her device, in one case, a person in Jamal Khashoggi's inner circle was hacked 4 days after his murder. The investigation points to an apparent attempt by Saudi Arabia and its close ally, the United Arab Emirates, to leverage NSO's spy technology after Khashoggi's death to monitor his associates and the Turkish murder investigation, even going so far as to select the phone of Istanbul's chief prosecutor for potential surveillance. Jamal Khashoggi was killed and dismembered at the Saudi consulate building in Istanbul, Turkey, in October of 2018. While the investigation mostly points to Khashoggi's close associates being targeted in the months after the murder, it also identified evidence suggesting that an NSO client targeted the phone of his former wife, Hanan El-Atr, several months before his death, between November of 2017 and April of 2018. A team of Saudi agents killed Khashoggi inside the Saudi consulate building in Istanbul, Turkey, during his visit there to pick up documents he needed to get married to his fiancée, Hatice Cengiz, who later became an outspoken advocate for accountability over his murder. Forensic analysis revealed that Cengiz's phone was first infected with Pegasus just 4 days after his murder on 6th of October 2018. Hatice Cengiz's phone was also hacked on two other days in October of 2018. Data analysis suggests that Saudi Arabia was behind the hacking. The website of the Middle East Monitor has more on the same story. The widow of dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi, who was assassinated by Saudi intelligence, sued the notorious Israeli spyware developed by the NSO group. Hanan El-Atr, a 52-year-old, sued Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates for their involvement in installing the Israeli company's Pegasus spyware on her mobile phone. Details of the attack on Khashoggi's inner circle were uncovered following a groundbreaking investigation by the Pegasus Project, a collaboration of more than 80 journalists from 17 media organizations in 10 countries. The phone belonging to Khashoggi's former wife, Hanan El-Atr, was on the list of 50,000 leaked members selected for possible surveillance by NSO clients. Hanan El-Atr says, "It is important to make everyone involved in this horrible crime accountable. My husband was a peaceful man." Moreover, Hanan added, she is determined to use the US courts of law to get full disclosure about who was potentially spying on her husband and those closest to him in the period before his murder. Once hacked by NSO's software, Pegasus, the targeted phone, K can be transformed into a surveillance device that can activate microphones and cameras without the user's knowledge, as well as read all their messages, harvest their address book, monitor their movement, and listen in on their phone calls. The Israeli regime has been under global pressure to stop the export of spyware, Pegasus, since last July, after a group of international rights and media organizations revealed that the Pegasus program produced by NSO was used to hack phones of journalists, prime ministers, officials, and human rights activists all over the world. NSO has also faced lawsuits and criticism from major technology companies, which accuse it of putting their customers at risk of hacking.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird Eutelsat 3B and Iran Sat or Bat 5 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Every night and every day, every night and every day, never forget to say, La ilaha illallah, never forget to say, La ilaha illallah.
IRIB English Radio, a herald of unity and solidarity amongst Islamic denominations.
Oh Lord, here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
You're listening to the program Hadith of the Day with Dr. Shiraz Hossein Agha on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program Hadith of the Day here at IRIB English Radio. Today on Hadith of the Day, we are going to be looking at a very beautiful hadith. And this hadith is narrated and transmitted from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam regarding lawful earnings and its effect on the answering of supplication. As you know, supplication or dua is very important in Islam and in religion in general. And, you know, it has certain conditions if it is to be answered. And when we make a request from God, it's not always answered because a lot of the conditions that have been mentioned for it have not been fulfilled by the person making the request. So those conditions have been mentioned in a lot of the hadith. One of those conditions is a condition that the person making the request should have earned his earnings, his wages, his money, his means of sustenance in a lawful way, in ways that has been prescribed by Allah Ta'ala. In this hadith, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam says, if any of you wants his supplication to be answered, then he should make a lawful earning and repay people their rights. Right? So, for example, if he has a job, he's going to the job and earning. That job shouldn't be, you know, prohibited in religion. Right? For example, you know, let's say that a person, there are, you know, these have, things have been mentioned in the respected books of jurisprudence. We don't want to go into detail regarding that. But by way of example, like let's say that there's a person and, you know, he earns his living, God forbid, from, you know, the making of intoxicants, right? Such a trade is prohibited. The earnings that he acquires through it are, you know, are illegitimate, you know. So if such a person, his prayers won't be answered. And repay the people for their rights. If he has a debt or he owes somebody some money, something, he should pay it back. For verily the supplication of a servant who has unlawful food in his stomach or has wronged anyone from Allah's creation will not be raised to Allah. Right? If somebody, you know, is in such a state and he prays to God, such prayers will not, you know, elevate. Such prayers will not elevate towards God. God will not listen to the prayers and he will not fulfill the request of the person. So this is one of the conditions for the prayer, the prayer's acceptance. And, you know, it should be fulfilled if we want our prayers to be answered. In a similar fashion, the Holy Prophet Muhammad said, verily a servant raises his hands to Allah in supplication while his food is unlawful. So how can his supplications be answered while he is in this state? Thank you for joining us here on Hadith of the Day. We were looking at lawful earnings as a condition for the answering of supplication in the words of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. Until next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Dr. Shiraz Hossein Agha for the program Hadith of the Day on RIB English Radio.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad.
Doing us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it?